Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Sherry Williams with the DCDC tells us how she feels about receiving the Ohio Governor's Award for the Arts. Next week, Shane Sullivan will take ownership of Canal Street Tavern, now the Canal Public House. We'll talk to him about that. Nativity, the pop opera, is back. Juliet Frumholt has the report. And we've got a story from Antioch student Al Najjar coming up later in the program. Up first, the federal online healthcare marketplace has been plagued with problems from its launch. President Obama promised a fix by November 30th. That deadline has come and gone, and things are markedly better, according to John Boblis, an economics professor at Miami University who specializes in the healthcare industry. He says significant improvements have been made for the consumer experience with faster download times and successful completion. However, Boblis adds there may be still snags when it comes to that data being transferred to insurance companies. He spoke with WISO News Director Emily McCord about all of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's been significant improvements. The question is going to be what happens as deadlines approach. So what the website has done is it's increased its capacity for how much traffic it can handle. However, what we tend to know is people tend to sign up for things at the last minute. And so we may see sort of a repeat if the, you know, the amount of volume that the website can handle isn't built up.
We've heard so many stories about all the problems that folks have been having going onto this website. Is it too late for the overall success of the Affordable Care Act now that all this time has been lost?
Well, you have to remember that, you know, with any type of major legislation, and including things like this creating the website, is that you're going to have snags. And so what really matters is getting people signed up for insurance. There may be some difficulty getting those people signed up for January 1st, but as long as those people get signed up within, you know, a few months into the, you know, next year, the program can still potentially be a great success. And the thing that I think about is while there's been a lot of snags and a lot of people have talked about the negatives associated with the website, is that what it has done is it's generated a lot of publicity for the website, and it's made people aware that this is now an option. So this might actually be something that's beneficial in the long run.
So the idea that bad publicity is better than no publicity at all?
Well, yeah, in some way that's exactly it. I mean, there's still a host of people who may not be aware that they have this option available to them. Because it's being talked about so much, those people who haven't been informed now know that they have an option to go get health care through this website.
Isn't it, though, a reality that, you know, particularly for the young people, that this program is relying on them to enroll because they're the younger people that are sort of subsidizing the older, less healthy folks? I mean, isn't it a reality that these might be the same people that are deterred from doing this, particularly after all these problems?
In order for the program to be very successful, you need to have young people and people who are healthy that will subsidize people who have pre-existing conditions and who are older. And, you know, some of those people that are younger may be deterred by that website not working. However, we know how people's behavior is they wait to the last minute to do things. And so what really matters is not so much what has happened in the last 2 months. What's going to matter is what's going to happen once this thing is fully operational and once people start actually having the insurance itself.
For a lot of young people, is it a concern that it's going to actually cost less for them to pay a penalty than it would be for a lot of their insurance plans?
Well, if you look at a lot of people who are younger, they're faced with a large number of challenges in terms of finding jobs that are high paying, in terms of being able to pay off college loans. And when you look at what type of jobs they're being offered, some of which don't have insurance, the penalty is significantly lower than the cost of insurance. And so therefore, it's an economic choice. And in many cases, though young people want to have insurance, they may just not be able to afford it. My honest guess is, you know, and this is my honest opinion, is that if you don't get these young folks invested in this, you're going to lead to something called an adverse selection death spiral. I don't know if you ever heard of that before.
No, that sounds pretty scary, though.
But basically what it means is that if sick people sign up, you've underestimated what the premium should have been. So next year you have to make the premium significantly higher. And then what happens is the people who are the healthiest say, this is too expensive, I'm going to drop out. And so you're only left with the really sick people. So what happens is that the premiums just spire higher and higher until the point where they're just unaffordable for everybody.
So, I mean, that doesn't necessarily spell good news for the health of Obamacare.
No, it doesn't. Again, the key to the success of this program is going to be getting those young people to enroll. And the question is will they come out? Now, do they want insurance? The answer is yes. But just because somebody says they want something doesn't mean that they'll act that way.
I've been speaking with John Boblis from Miami University. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
The Twin Towers neighborhood in Dayton was established more than 100 years ago, and it's been through a lot. Recently, 84 new houses opened in the area for low-income families through a public-private partnership organized by East End Community Services. But what does this mean for a neighborhood trying to turn itself around? Lewis Wallace talks to Jan Lepore-Jenelson of East End Community Center about how the neighborhood is changing.
Is it possible to improve the neighborhood without risking pushing people out of the neighborhood?
A lot of the people who live in this community are so poor that they can't afford to live in our low-income housing that we just built. We don't have a housing problem in our community. We have an income problem in our community. That's where we need to be focusing attention.
What does it take to establish that kind of stability that you're talking about?
I think you need a mix of support services, relationships that are supportive among the families who live here, and then decent housing, and then the big institutions like police and schools that are really focused on improving the quality for everybody. This neighborhood alone, 63% of our children live below the poverty line. Well, that's tough. And the only way we're going to break that cycle is to get our kids a good education and get them through college or some kind of post-secondary credential program so that they can be successful breadwinners later on. So these are generational issues. These just don't go away.
For the parents of the children who you're talking about, what are their prospects like and what are some of the issues that you're seeing?
We've all heard that there are lots of jobs out there and that there's a very high unemployment rate. And the gap is training and skill levels. What we need desperately is some job training for the population that is kind of languishing out there without having access to living wage jobs. I mean, you can always get a fast food job, but you can't raise a family on a fast food job.
And describe to me a little bit more about what Twin Towers has been through. You're saying it's been in a decline recently. What was it like before?
When the highway punched through in the late 50s, early 60s, things started to change. People couldn't take the noise and the congestion from the construction. A lot of the German families that had made their homes here around St. Mary Church had started to move out into the suburbs because now the suburbs were opening up, Huber Heights, even what is now called Riverside. A lot of people from the neighborhood moved out. That left a lot of homes then for sale or for rent. And about that same time, a lot of the migrants were coming up from the Appalachian states in search of the jobs in the factories. The houses were old and they were hard to keep up. And eventually, the structures just started to go into decline. And as they were rental properties, there were a lot of families moving in and out on a fairly rapid basis. And that's a lot of wear and tear on a home. But they tell me this was a wonderful neighborhood, you know, back in the day. And our goal is to bring it back that same way.
That's Jan Lepore-Gentleson from East End Community Services. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Earlier this week, Canal Street Tavern received a new name as founder Mick Montgomery ended his association with the venue. This is the first of several changes patrons will see. Canal Street Tavern will now be called Canal Public House. New owner Shane Sullivan says he chose the name because it gives the bar a new identity, but pays homage to the legacy of Canal Street Tavern, which has been a destination for music fans for more than 30 years. So tell me what changes are headed our way for the venue.
Most of them are what Mick and I originally talked about were his original ideas that he wanted to do. One's to, you know, update the sound system and actually update the board as far as the we would add a kitchen, a small kitchen, which had been there long ago, and we're just going to do another kitchen, a small one. It's not to make the place into a sports bar or anything. It's just to add some food for people. And, yes, there is a patio outside that we added. We weren't able to do anything with it. We just were able to go to the city and able to get the space marked off, and we have a small gate up out there. But, you know, we're allowed to have alcoholic beverages out there at the time. And just cleaning the place up a little bit, redoing the lighting and redoing the restrooms. But it would still stay an entertainment place, you know?
I heard something about moving the bar. Is that,
an
option?
Could, yes, yes, yes. That was originally in Mick's plans as well. It makes sense to move the bar over to the side of where the kitchen would be. That way I could make more seating available, and some bigger acts are with the union, right? And the union won't let you play some places unless you have X amount of seating. So it opens up a bunch of other troubles for us, but to have the bigger acts come in, that would be awesome.
There's also been talk of introducing kind of like an Austin City Limits business model and doing those live feeds and telecasts.
That is the main goal that we're going to try to do. I would love to have just our main feed or our recordings to go to Stivers so we could have young people doing the mix down of something off of that, or, you know, like an internship, so the younger people could get involved with the whole process of everything. As far as the Austin City Limits video side of how that goes, if you've watched any of it recently, they have about 4 static cameras and then one that kind of moves around. And I think that would be really good for the upcoming videographers and the sound engineers. Stivers has a program. My daughter goes there. I thought that would be a good idea.
So it opens the door for some collaborative efforts.
Yes, definitely.
What are your biggest challenges for that at this point?
We're able to do the recordings right now and able to do a live feed. As far as the video goes, it would take us to buy a couple video cameras. And I'm talking to some people, but you got to do one thing at a time. And I guess the best thing for us to start off doing is recording almost all the shows and then doing a podcast, and then whenever we need to do a live feed, we can do a live feed.
So tell me, how excited are you?
I'm very excited. Always scared at the same time, as anyone would be, to open up a business. I did Southwark Tavern from scratch, but this is going to be my first one where I'm actually the owner of it. So big shoes to follow in, and it's a big task in front of us. I hope we have the support from everybody in Dayton and nationally. I have February booked. I have the Buffalo Killers on the 14th. I think we have the Guided by Voices coming up possibly in April. So I've been around the music scene for some while, and I really appreciate everyone that sees the future of what needs to happen. And hopefully not everyone stays in the past, which is nice to reminisce about the past, but we're just going to try to keep what was there and build upon it.
Give me a time frame on some of these changes and what will patrons be noticing over the next couple of months.
Throughout the winter months, we'll be slowly doing things. You can't just do everything and shut the doors. So you got to do things slowly. And depending on our cash flow, it'll be a slow thing. But our goal is to have most things into place by springtime. You know, the ballpark will be open. I know the ballpark doesn't play anything into do what the music has to, but that area of traffic and the festivals and things like that will start to happen. So, and we'll be able to have the patio up and going and looking nice. So it's a slow process. It's not like it's going to happen overnight. So everyone should be patient, which it usually helps out by people coming in and, you know, hey, what did they do this week? And people feel better about spending their money at somewhere where they know the money's going to go back into the place and fixing it up.
Shane Sullivan with Canal Public House. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Two longtime contributors to the arts in Dayton will be the recipients of the 2014 Ohio Governor's Award for the Arts. Dayton Philharmonic Music Director Neil Gittleman and Sherry Williams with the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company were selected with 4 other winners from around the state for the prestigious award. In a release statement, Gittleman, who has been with the Dayton Philharmonic since the mid-80s, said he was honored and humbled by the award. The conductor added that although the award puts a spotlight on him, it really honors the Dayton Philharmonic's and now the DPAA's focus on community engagement and service over many years. Sherry Sparkle Williams received the Individual Artist Award for her 40 years of work with the DCDC. She was excited by the news.
Oh, my gosh. It hasn't even sunk in yet. It's just amazing. Oh, it's been my whole livelihood. You know, it's at the beginning, I think I never, ever thought I'd be dancing at all this long. But it's such a big part of me, and the environment is just so nurturing and challenging and inspiring. And it's afforded me the opportunity to create lasting and encouraging relationships with people all over the world, learning all the time and, you know, and being able to share what I've learned with others. But it's just, you know, kind of awing when I think about it.
When did you learn that you received the award, or had you already known that you were nominated?
No, I was nominated. I think my friend started nominating me maybe a couple years ago when I first heard about it, and then last year, yeah, I think it was 2 years ago, and then I just got the information. I didn't know it had gone in again this year, though. But I got the notification, let's see, just a few days before Thanksgiving.
Great. So you had additional reason to be thankful.
Absolutely.
Well, great. So what are you doing now? I know you're still with DCDC.
I am still a dancer with the company and also the company fitness trainer. I've been their trainer since about 1990 or so. It's
okay.
Been a while.
Yeah. It's probably a lot of hard work to keep the dancers fit.
Well, you know, they're pretty fit. It's lots of work being able to challenge them. That's great on both parts. I have a good time doing it and complain the time, but they respond really well.
Well, listen, congratulations on the award. Any final comments about the award? How do your friends and family are reacting?
Yeah, they're like, oh, you go, girl, that kind of thing. Because it was, you know, they didn't know anything, any prior notification of any other nominations or that kind of thing. So they were like, oh, wow, I had no idea, and you know, tell me more about it, that kind of thing, too. But they're all happy for me, and I'm just, I don't know what to say. I'm so thankful. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't believe it's me.
Well, great. Thanks, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. As we near the holiday season, preparations are underway for the 6th annual production of Nativity, the Pop Opera. It runs December 12th through the 14th at the Beaver Creek Church of the Nazarene and December 15th at the Gathering on Yankee Street in Dayton. WYSO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with one of the show's creators, J. Todd Anderson, about the year's production. She began by asking him about the structure of the show.
We do this thing every Christmas time, and it's it's kind of a narrative approach of an opera telling, the story, you know, the whole baby Jesus story with grandma's mantle and everything. And we tell it all the way from the very beginning, John the Baptist, and it's all, you know, the transition of the Christ child. And we do it all in music. It's all opera. It's all pop music and things like that, and except for one little scene where the innkeeper throws Joe and Mary out of the inn, not physically, of course, but he does tell them to hit the road, and that's where we stop. That's what I call the Kafka break. That's where they go to the inn, and they get, kind of tossed. And then, of course, we proceed with the rest of the show, and everything's there, all the characters there, you know, and the innkeeper, we threw him in there, and we also have a mime who helps out because we're so poor, we got to have somebody who's an actor and a stagehand. So that's basically Nativity, the Pop Opera. And we've been doing it for a while, and people seem to enjoy it, and we're here to provide again, and we do it for one cause, and that's A Kid Again. And all the proceeds collected go to A Kid Again. Everything collected on all six of our shows goes to the organization A Kid Again.
How have you experienced the evolution of this show, of, you know, the way that you're presenting it from year to year and the way that audiences are connecting with it?
Well, the biggest thing is that it's not like movies. And as you know, that's what I do is movies. And this is my theatrical experience. This is
you know, in movies we prep everything and then we shoot it and then we try to edit together so it works. But in theater, it doesn't work that way. So every year we find things that work, and then we try to weave them into next year's program. And things that don't work, we cut them. It's not like editing, you know, but we do cut them. And we try to hang on to the things that work, and we don't analyze it too much, but if that works, we just go with it. And through the years, we've been able to develop this show to the point where the things that work, we keep them in there, and the things that don't work, well, they're just long gone. And that's the best way that I can say that we change things. And if one of our performers gets inspired, well, and they do something, we just hope we can capture that lightning in a bottle again. And through the years, we've kind of developed the show into a nice, tight little 92-minute show. The other thing is like, when I was out promoing it last year, there was a lot of really silly things that I had missed. For instance, when I'd say, based on a true story, I got a response from people. Through the years, we struggled with the choreography on the show because we'd never had enough money to buy a choreographer. And then this year, like a really magic Christmas present, Bronwyn Owsley became available to be our choreographer.
You've also got Sherman Andress coming
in. Yes, we do. I wanted to bring in somebody who has a little bit of history and attraction. And Sherman has been around the block so many times, he's bumping into himself, man. That guy is number one gospel singer. He used to be with the Imperials, and then he was with Andress Blackwood, and now he's on Gaither on Sundays. And I saw him in 1972 when I was a kid at the Hare Arena, believe it or not. They actually had gospel acts that came in there, too, back in those days. And there he was, up on the stage, and they had these real cool Elvis jumpsuits and stuff. They tried to make these corny jokes about him breaking the color barrier. But I could tell that the heat was on Sherman. And, man, when he sang, I never forgot it. And so when I was combing around trying to find a good singer for our show, his thought came to my mind, and I called him up, and here we are. So I think it's going to be a wonderful show because the guy's, he's a beautiful, beautiful singer. And hopefully everybody will come and hear him.
WYSO's Juliet Fromholt talking with J. Todd Anderson about Nativity, the pop opera on stage December 12th through the 14th at Beaver Creek Church of the Nazarene, December 15th at the Gathering in Dayton. For an extended interview with Anderson and a conversation with Sherman Andress, tune into Kaleidoscope on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock on WYSO. This year, WYSO has had an Antioch College student working with us. Keijin Higashibaba is in the 2016 class at the college and is currently the producer of The Antioch Word, a podcast about the school. This week, we hear an excerpt from the latest episode, which Keijin recorded from her storytelling class. It's part biography and part myth, written and performed by fellow Antioch student Al Najjar.
I know what you all think when you hear my name. Lilith. Strong, stubborn, rebellious, traitorous, mother of demons, queen of vengeance. I do not blame you for what you think. Some of it might even be true. But tonight, I wish to tell you the true story, every detail exactly as it happened all those ages ago when the world was new. Then, only then, I will ask you to judge me as you see fit. Most of you have heard the story before. The story of Adam and Eve, the story of Eden. But what many of you don't know is that it was written twice. The first time, while describing the creation of humanity, it says man and woman he created them. Only the second time does it say that the presence created Eve from Adam's rib. That was because a lot happened before Eve. Mistakes, beauty, regrets, and, of course, me. It began, of course, at the beginning. The beginning of everything. I opened my eyes slowly, squinting in the sunlight. I am lying cushioned on tender new grass, soft and emerald green. I breathe in. My first breath. The air is sweet, invigorating. It tastes like life. All I hear is the gentle rush of the wind and the distant crash of waves. But somehow, I know my purpose. I was created to rule over all of this, take care of it. I look to my side and see a figure lying beside me. I know his purpose as well. He is to rule with me, be my partner, my equal. And at that moment, nothing can ever seem better. I help him to his feet, and we stand together gazing in awe at this marvel the presence has entrusted us with. It seems endless. We spent the first day in an almost euphoric bliss, discovering, breathing, taking it all in. The sky begins to darken. At first, we are afraid, but then we see the moon and the stars. My partner thinks this is a good time to rest. I agree. As we settle down, we hear something moving in the nearby foliage. We do not fear. Our fellow creatures would never harm us. We watch it emerge. She is beautiful, strong. I see her muscles rippling under orange and black stripes. Her yellow eyes glow in the darkness. My partner looks at her intensely for a moment and then says, "I name you Tiger." I look at him for a moment and say, "I do not think we should name a creature that is so strong and beautiful. We can never sum up all that is this creature in one word." "Of course I can," he says. "I rule over all the creatures in this world. I may name them as I wish." I look at him with utter disbelief. "You can, but that does not mean you should. And, as your co-ruler, I think that if we are to name our fellow creatures, we should at least think about it for a little longer." "Co-ruler," he scoffs. "I am ruler. You support me in my decisions, help me in my rulings. The presence created us equally, equal strength, equal power," I say forcefully. "I do not accept what you say," he says. I do not know what to do. My perfect world is tumbling down around me. My partner, my other half, he talks as if I am lesser than him. He talks as though he is more suited to rule over this beautiful world than I. I know that this is untrue. I am just as much a ruler as he is. The presence made me that way. I take a deep breath. I say, "If that is what you feel, then I must leave. Go my own way." I suddenly notice what I have just done. I just deserted the only other member of my species. I just deserted my other half. As hard as I try to hold back, I feel tears coming to my eyes. I cannot let him see me cry. I cannot let him see me break like this. I turn and run, trying to somehow escape it all. Just keep running. Branches cut into my bare feet. Cold wind burns my skin. Keep running. I feel sand under my feet. Keep running. I see the wild ocean before me. I know I must stop now. I can stop now. I am far enough away. He can no longer see me. I can no longer see him. I see a small dark cave facing the sea. I run into it, and hidden from the world, I break down. I try to stop the tears, try to hold back, but I cannot. I know what I said, what I did was right. I know he was wrong for the way he treated me, but even knowing you are right doesn't stop the confusion, the doubt. There is no going back now. I did what needed to be done, but it was not easy. What was I to do now? In the morning, I knew exactly what my purpose was. I knew exactly what was wanted of me. And now, nothing. I wrap my arms around myself and look out at the great sea in front of me, waves crashing angrily against the rocks, salty spray hitting my face, a presence. I hastily dry my eyes. I see before me a being with giant, majestic wings. "I have been sent from the presence," he says. "I have been sent to tell you to return to your partner." "I cannot," I reply with as much confidence, as much strength as I can muster. "Then the presence is forced to punish you. From this day until the end of days, you are to be the mother of all demons." The being left. It was over. As I watched from the half-formed world which was now my home, I saw as the presence created a new woman, my replacement. He created her not as her own being, but from the bones of my old partner, a lesser being that would be okay with her supposed place, that would be okay with being a helper and not an equal. It killed me inside. I do not pretend to understand the presence's ways, but I promised myself at that moment that I would always be watching, always be pushing the confines of my realm, trying somehow to instill in future women a little of my essence, a little of my will. I will try to be with them when they have to make difficult choices, when they have to do what they believe to be right, even when it means giving everything up. I will try to give them strength. And nothing will be able to stop me. So now that you know what happened that day, I ask you, what do you think of me now?
That was Al Najjar, Antioch College student class of 2016. The storytelling class at Antioch College will be showcasing monologues and other original pieces at a public event on the Antioch College campus Sunday, December 15th from 4 to 6 p.m. Visit WISO.org to hear more from the Antioch Word. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks again for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up next, The Book Nook.